Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the third episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today's Friday because we've done two episodes strictly on transfers with no guests. Today we have a little bit of a more free-form episode. At the top, Alex and I are going to talk about all the big transfer rumors of the past few days. Then we're going to be joined by our dear friend, Andrew Barker, senior writer from Variety, to get into some Inter talk, pay tribute to Anthony Bourdain, and then preview all the biggest rock summer tours. So if you just want to listen to football, once we get to Anthony Bourdain, that's your cue to drop off. But everyone else, I think you'll really enjoy that chat. I had a blast and a lot of good nuggets on there. But before we get to that, I'm joined by our great friend, co-host, producer of the podcast, Alex Goldberg. So Alex, there's been a lot of buzz recently, and I think it has a lot to do with Sarri to Chelsea gaining some momentum. That Gonzalo Higuain and Di Marzio last night said on his TV show that there's a chance he could be leaving Juve because it seems like something in his relationship with the club isn't what it used to be. So I wanted to ask you, Alex, you've been following Serie A for a while, so I think you have a better understanding of Higuain than just the guy that chokes in big matches. So let me ask you your reaction. Say Higuain were to join Chelsea, how would you feel about that?
I'd feel really good, and I know a lot of the Chelsea fan base is very split on that. I think many people who don't want Gonzalo Higuain maybe think he's overrated, but also are just looking at the fact that he's 30 years old, and I think a lot of Chelsea fans, including myself, want to have a youth incoming. They want to have top academy players get a chance, but that's actually why I'm totally in favor of Higuain coming to Stamford Bridge if it were to happen, and for a couple reasons, but let's start off with the youth factor. There's no striker really ready yet that's a young striker at Chelsea to fully take over. They have Tammy Abraham at Swansea, didn't have a great year. They have a really young kid named Deshaun Redan who's clearly not ready. So David, if Gonzalo Higuain came in, he's 30 years old. He still has, in my opinion, 2-3 good years of playing as a top striker. And I think it would be the perfect transition period for a team like Chelsea who don't have a young striker ready. So I would like it, but you mentioned Sarri. That's a big part. I would really like it if Sarri was coming. If Higuain is coming without Sarri, well, then maybe they should honestly just stick with what they have, and they meaning Chelsea. But if Sarri's coming, I'm absolutely in favor of Higuain because they've proved together that they can be prolific. Higuain was awesome for Sarri at Napoli. And also, the main issue for Chelsea fans right now is who's the best player on the team? Eden Hazard. So Chelsea need to build around Eden Hazard. He needs a striker that can consistently put in goals. Hopefully that's Alvaro Morata next year, but you can see what Diego Costa did today in the World Cup. Eden Hazard has always played well with clinical strikers, and that's what Gonzalo Higuain is, bar maybe an important clutch moment, as you already alluded to. But I think Higuain would actually do pretty well in the Premier League, David. He's already played for Real Madrid, Napoli, and Juve, three very good teams, but he still hasn't played in the Premier League. Almost every player at one point at least thinks about playing in the Premier League. And doesn't he kind of seem like a Premier League striker? He really does. He seems absolutely like brute. He can do the physicality part of it. I definitely think if he came to Chelsea, he'd be motivated and he'd be rather good. I'm not saying he's going to put up the numbers he did for Napoli or even for Juventus a couple seasons ago, but I still think he has a lot left in the tank. But my answer on a whole is very dependent on Maurizio Sarri coming. If Sarri is coming, I am 100% in favor of it. So David, that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I completely agree. A lot of this move would have to do with if Sarri is there. Now, again, I know a lot of people that maybe aren't that familiar with Higuain and just really maybe watch him tournaments in the Champions League, maybe don't have an appreciation for how fantastic of a duo Higuain and Sarri were together. At Napoli, Higuain broke the record of goals in a Serie A season playing for Sarri at Napoli, a record that had been there for over 50 years. It went well beyond goal scoring. Like the way Higuain played, setting up the team, pushing back, helping in the run of play was really unbelievable. I always said, Higuain isn't just the best striker in Serie A, he's the best player in Serie A when he was with Sarri. So I could, that would make a lot of sense if Sarri goes there. I don't think the move would happen without it. I still think even without Sarri, it would still be a good move for Chelsea. in the short term. As far as the Juve side of the ledger on the deal, I was very surprised when there started to be buzz about this, just because I know what a huge sacrifice Juve did to get Higuain. I mean, they essentially reinvested most of the money from Pogba, if not all of it, to get Higuain, an older player than Pogba. But just because Juve saw in previous years how hard it is to get one of those great number nines that make the difference and that score consistently, especially get them to agree to come to Serie A. So Juve made a huge financial commitment to bring it there, and replacing Higuain with someone comparable is going to be at least as expensive. So if Juve wants to move Higuain without taking a loss on their books on the amortized value of what's left, they would have to get around 60 million euro. Higuain's going to turn 31 in December. But, you know, I think with Sarri, you'd get a lot of production. When I look at the Juve side of things, if Higuain goes, to me, the most logical thing would be to move Dybala back to the central striker role. Now, a lot of people, when they look at Dybala's body type, his ability to dribble, maybe you don't really see him as a classic center forward, but that has always been his best position. Like at Palermo, he was devastating that way. On occasion, we see him playing that role at Juve. I think it would make a lot of sense if Higuain goes to move Dybala there, give Bernardeschi more time, and maybe have him start up front with Douglas Costa. There's still Cuadrado as well. We know Juve's been linked to Martial. So maybe Juve replaces that number nine position with Dybala and then just tries to fill in around him. The other thing is, I think this season that just ended, Higuain answered a lot of question on his clutchness. He had two of the three most clutch goals for Juve of the season. He had the game winner in Napoli at the San Paolo. Granted, that was early in the season, but that was a huge statement by Juve. Then he had the goal against Inter, which really was essentially the Scudetto decider. The other goal, most important goal of the season in Serie A for Juve, was Dybala against Lazio, but the other ones were Higuain. And my final thought on this whole Higuain thing, to me, the moment that I thought was the most beautiful moment of the season for Juve that just passed is when they eliminated Spurs in London. There was this beautiful embrace at the end of the match between Buffon, Dybala, and Higuain. If you haven't seen it, it's really a beautiful moment, unless you're a Buffon hater. And, you know, to me, it's really pretty remarkable that out of that trio of players, the most likely to stay at Juve is Dybala. I would have never thought that in a million years. And you showed me that picture and told me, guess what, there's a very good chance that just one of these three is going to be at Juve next season. Dybala would have been the last one. But this is the new transfer window. Madness all the time. The unexpected will happen. And this is why our podcast is so much fun to do. And the other reason why this podcast is so much fun to do is because our listeners are fantastic. The reason we got great reviews on the content is you guys ask us fantastic questions that we can answer. So if you want to send us a question, please use the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. What do you make of Mino Raiola supposedly offering Marco Verratti to Manchester United?
So I'll say this. I think, you know, before I really got into transfers and really got a strong sense of how all this worked, when I heard the notion of an agent offering a player, one of his players, to another team, I assumed, oh, that must mean his current club wants him gone. He's definitely leaving. What is happening? I'll give you another example. I very rarely do reporting, and I mean very rarely, like maybe twice a year. But sometimes some people tell me something. And, you know, last year, right after the Champions League final, you know, I tweeted that Dani Alves had been offered to Premier League clubs. And it was really interesting in the telephone game on Twitter. People, instead of retweeting that tweet, said, David Amoyal said that Juve offered Dani Alves to Premier League clubs. I hadn't said anything at all about Juve because they weren't the ones that offered him. It was his entourage. So don't assume that because an agent is offering a player to someone else that the player is leaving. Even just look in January, it was leaked that Raiola had offered Pogba to Manchester City of all teams. Like, agents do this a lot. They like to gauge the value of their player, so they'll offer him to other clubs and see if the club's interested, what they'd be willing to pay, and that gives them a pretty good idea of the status of their player. They can use that information to get a better terms and extension or maybe try to force a move. So, you know, we know Raiola has a great relationship with Manchester United. It seems like Verratti, you know, at PSG isn't the golden child that he used to be. But at the end of the day, if you followed PSG, by now you have to know they will not let a player leave that's on the contract that they want to keep. It's really that simple. They are one of those clubs that are really stubborn. And once you sign a contract with them, you're basically letting them decide what your future is going to be. So at the end of the day, ultimately, if Verratti goes to Manchester United or any other club, what Raiola offers is really that important. It really comes down to what PSG wants to do. But again, maybe there's a chance that PSG, you know, maybe trying to start a new cycle, maybe things could change. But as of now, I think it's important for our listeners to know that agents offer their players to clubs all the time. I wouldn't read too much into this quite yet.
All right, David, next Twitter question. What would Alisson bring to Real Madrid?
Man, I got to tell you, if Real Madrid sign Alisson and it's looking like there's a good chance this would happen, they agreed to personal terms with him. I think Roma, you know, although they're in a much better financial situation, they were cleared of financial fair play issues. Now they can operate, you know, like a club that doesn't have any. It's very hard to keep a player that's agreed to term with Real Madrid. They could make a massive plusvalenza on him, but a huge offer. It seems like, you know, including bonuses, they could get 60 to 70 million euro, which for a keeper is an amazing return. So I got to tell you, I've been so impressed with Alisson. Our listeners know this. As just as a pure shot stopper, really remarkable season in Serie A. Then you add to it how good he is with his feet, like really remarkably good with his feet. It's just scary how good Real Madrid, they could be set at the goalkeeper position for 10, 12 years with him. I'm a huge fan of his. And the other thing too, Alex, that I was thinking, it's pretty remarkable. You and I went to see Roma play against Juve at Foxborough last summer. I never imagined, I mean, Alisson was playing. I was like, let's see if he can live up to what Szczesny did last season. Little did I know that we were witnessing a keeper then become the hottest keeper on the transfer market. I don't know if you remember that match, but it's a really remarkable how his star has risen since then.
David, I'll admit, I barely knew who Alisson was when we went to that match. I mean, I knew I knew of him, but he had done nothing at that point to really gain my attention. And wow, what a difference. Not even a year makes. Really impressive season from him. And I echo, if Real Madrid get Alisson, they're doing great business because, you know, they're probably bringing in two young Brazilian players. We've talked about how their squad is kind of aging. And then anytime you bring in a 25-year-old damn good keeper, you're having a good summer transfer window. That's for sure. All right, David, let's stay on keepers. Could Liverpool sign Lazio keeper Strakosha? And what is he like?
So, full disclosure, Di Marzio hasn't tweeted anything about this quite yet, hasn't reported anything on it. I know there's been a lot of reports in other places of it. Someone that I know that really knows things about Liverpool told me, get ready to write about Strakosha because a lot of people are going to want to hear your take on it. So I think there's a pretty decent chance that there could be some momentum for this. Now, you know, Liverpool was linked to Alisson. They could end up getting the starting keeper for the other team in Rome, and I actually think he's a quite good consolation prize. He's been a star the past few seasons, been one of the best keepers in Serie A since. You know, it doesn't stand out to me, his ball distribution being anything like Alisson, but as a shot stopper, very intriguing. He's excellent at stopping penalty kicks, has played well in big matches, so I think this would be quite a nice consolation prize and certainly a massive upgrade on the keepers I've seen on Liverpool in the past few seasons.
All right, well, let's kind of stay on Lazio a little bit. Is it true that Milinkovic-Savic has agreed to join Juventus?
Well, as far as I know, not at all. I mean, I definitely know that Juve is interested in it. I keep saying that to me this is a long shot that they'll get him. A, because of their relationship with Lazio, and B, the amount of clubs that are interested in him. So as of now, as far as I know, that's not the case. Let's see, you know, what Juve does. They would certainly have to sell a couple of players. Even selling Higuain, though, for 60 million, I mean, that wouldn't be much of a profit. It'd be really just to keep and not take a loss on his original transfer. So let's see what happens. But as of now, I don't think there's really anything imminent with Milinkovic-Savic in general.
All right, David, this has been talked about a little bit with my Chelsea fans. What are the odds Daniel Rugani leaves Juventus?
As far as the Chelsea aspect, I think it's similar to Higuain. This would be a Sarri move. They were together at Empoli. Sarri tried to bring Rugani to Napoli to have him back. Now, people that listen to the podcast know I'm not the biggest Rugani fan. I think he's okay. I don't think he's great. But I think, he still has a lot of value, a young center back with experience at a big club. I think Juve would be somewhat open to moving him if they can get a massive return for him, like 35, 40 million euro. The other thing that's interesting for Juve is, what's going to happen with Benatia. We know they brought in Caldara back. They've been linked to some center backs. Savic, the one on Atletico Madrid, De Ligt on Ajax would be quite expensive. So let's see what happens. I'm not sure if Juve would sell both Benatia and Rugani, but, after last summer, nobody expected Bonucci to go. So at the center back position, you just really never know at Juve.
I'm kind of stating the obvious here, and I know the prices would be different, but honestly, if you're interested in Rugani, you should be interested in Matthias De Ligt. That's my opinion.
I think you're totally right.
All right, good. I'm glad. All right, next Twitter question. If Maurizio Sarri does join Chelsea, do you think he'll rotate more and focus on developing young players?
This would only be if Chelsea flat out tell him this is what we want you to do, and we'll deal with the growing pains as this happens. I'd be very surprised of this. I'm going to die on the hill that Napoli's depth was much better than people made it out to be. I love Sarri, but I just don't think he got the most out of the squad. Napoli had a lot of intriguing young players they would have liked to develop. Marco Rog, Diarra, who barely played. Zielinski, he had gained more confidence in, but he had Zielinski with him at Empoli as well. So I don't know. I feel like, especially if Sarri were to go to Chelsea and feel the pressure of doing well in the Premier League, we know how Chelsea are with managers, it would be tough. So I'd be very surprised, and it would have to come as a clear director from the club.
My thing with that is I would be nervous that he wouldn't play young players. However, if Chelsea just don't sign anybody, he might have to play some young players. So I'm in a weird position as a Chelsea fan of wanting a manager to come in ASAP, but almost not wanting that many players to come in, because I am one of those people that likes to push the youth agenda. So we'll just have to see. All right, David, next Twitter question. What is the latest on Yunus joining Napoli?
So look, he is on the contract with Napoli, at the expiring contract with Ajax. They agreed to have him come for the following season, signed the contract, came to the city. It was a really bizarre situation what happened there. Then he disappeared, that he didn't want to stay at Napoli, but he's on the contract. And look, you've seen it firsthand with the Sarri situation. Napoli see Yunus as an asset that they owe. They got him for free. They can make a nice plusvalenza on him if they sell him. Maybe they decide to loan him to a team like Parma and Sassuolo, maybe get his value up and then sell him. Who knows? Maybe with Ancelotti at Napoli, he'd be intrigued to work with him. I'd be surprised if he's on Napoli, but I'm sure Napoli's going to want to get something out of this. That's just how they roll, and to be honest, I don't blame him.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Why aren't Inter using their Chinese club to sell players to meet their FFP parameters?
This is a good question, and this has come up a lot. There's been some talk about this when Inter was bought by Suning in the first place, but I think Inter feels that maybe would be completely brazen way to get around FFP, and quite frankly, they have a better way of getting around FFP if you've been, and I'm not saying getting around it because this is ultimately within the rules. What Inter has done in recent years, they did it last summer, they've been doing it a lot this summer, is sell some of their youth team players, and Inter has always had one of the best youth teams in Italy, to other clubs in Serie A for fairly inflated fees, and that's how they meet their financial fair play requirements. It's a pure profit on a player you develop yourself, then eventually they'll probably do other deals with those same clubs that are advantageous to that club. And look, you know, if you want to get all upset over it, like, to be honest, this is trick is as old as the history of football. Like, how many deals have Milan and Genoa done that are kind of along these lines? Juve, like, has been known to do this over and over again. Instead of once the co-ownership deals went out the window, Juve would just buy players and loan them to teams, sell them, have a buyback. Like, these are a lot of accounting moves. So I feel like Inter has just a better way than doing a brazen thing of selling, you know, D'Ambrosio for $70 million to Suning. But I do think one way that they can use the Suning connection is we're seeing it with Dembele, the midfielder from Tottenham. They're like, look, you can come play with us for a season, maybe 2 years, and get paid, you know, well, but then you can go to our Chinese club and get paid a fortune. So I think they can still use the fact that they have the Chinese club, but maybe not necessarily for FFP, but to make it more attractive to players who could potentially join them.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Why do Roma continue to be linked with Murray when Skorupski is probably better at the moment?
So Roma, I think last season Roma just had an amazing goalkeeper duo. Like Skorupski, who had played at Empoli, was really, really good for them, came back to Roma. But Alisson was so good that he barely got off the bench, if at all. And, you know, there's been a lot of buzz on Skorupski being sold this summer when it seemed that Alisson was staying. But now I think there's a very good chance that Alisson would be gone. So I think in a way it would make sense to keep him. And I think it makes perfect sense for Roma to look for a young keeper like Mire, very highly rated. He played for Spal, owned by Udinese. And look, you know, in general, it looks like Roma this summer really targeting a lot of young players. I think it makes sense. They can develop them, eventually turn a profit on them. So I think if they bring in Mire, who's very talented, to replace Alisson, they're definitely going to need a veteran who brings some guarantees, because being the goalkeeper at Roma is a pressure-packed situation. So in an ideal world, if I was at Roma, I'd like to keep those two as a duo. I think that would work out pretty well.
All right, this is an interesting question, David. How important is it for clubs to have a good relationship when it comes to completing transfer business?
Very important. And look, you know, there are some rival clubs that will try just not to never do business with one another, but we're seeing that changing a little bit. Like, I've mentioned this many times. I never in a million years expected Fiorentina to sell Bernardeschi to Juve, and then they did. So maybe if you're a Juve fan, there is some hope for Milinkovic-Savic. But there are definitely clubs that have very strong relationships. One thing that I think is really important for fans, when they look at transfer deals, don't look at them in a vacuum. Like, if there's multiple deals between clubs, or maybe sometimes multiple deals with players with the same agent, kind of look at them together. There can be a little bit of a give and a take, especially in the way clubs put on their balance sheet, how they record transfers. So I think it's definitely very important. If you follow Serie A, there are definitely some clubs that do business with one another fairly consistently. And again, it's for really good reasons. So I actually think this is one of the most underrated aspects of the transfer business.
All right, last Twitter question, David. Let's move away from football. This is a question that you've asked our guests constantly, but now it's turned around on you. How did you start your career in journalism?
And, you know, I kind of laugh, too, when I hear journalism, because I don't really consider myself really that. Like, I have a career in finance. I'm calling into our podcast from my office and financial services. But, you know, this has been a passion of mine that developed. I never consider myself a reporter like Di Marzio, Fabrizio Di Romano. Like I've said, you know, once in a blue moon, I'll stumble into some news with some people that I know and I'll do some reporting, but I'm not a reporter. I consider myself, you know, a podcast host. Like, I'm good at identifying angles, pretty good at doing analysis. I'll let people judge if I'm good at it or not. Like, I feel I can come up with pretty good concepts for a column to analyze a situation, maybe try looking at it from a different perspective. I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of transfer business. If ESPN asks me how likely is this deal to happen, I can write a good column on it. But, you know, I don't really consider myself a journalist in the sense of reporting. But, you know, how I got started is you know, I've always had a passion for Serie A, had a passion for, you know, the internet eventually, reading message boards. You know, I followed Juve as a kid growing up. You know, I've kind of lost my fandom. I know people don't believe that, but I truly have. Last season, I genuinely was rooting for Napoli. But, you know, when I started writing, it was about Juve because it was what I knew the most of. And I started writing on this site called Juve FC. We're going to have the founder of the site on next week. I'm really excited to have him on. And, you know, what that taught me was, like, you know, having discipline, writing an article or two every week, trying to look at things as much as possible from an objective point of view. I still remember many times, you know, having some takes that fans disagreed with. That hasn't changed since. And, you know, with that, you know, I started really branching out a little bit more, writing for other Serie A sites. Eventually, Vavel, who was this big sports site in Spain, for some reason they identified me as someone who could help them launch the site in the U.S. That gave me a lot of experience, you know, working with other people. And, you know, then I took the big leap when I pitched to Di Marzio doing the English page. You know, at first he was very reticent, but I told him I think this would really work. And, you know, through trial and error, I became a lot better at it. So, you know, my advice to anyone that wants to get into writing, wants to follow the little success that I've had, is just do the work. Like, I can't stress enough, like, having reps is the most important thing. Our podcast now is so much better than when we started because we've been doing a lot of them. So if you want to, not that I'm a good writer by any means, but you just have to do it, take reps and just try to improve yourself there. So next week, I'm looking forward to having Rob from Juve FC on the Friday episode. So we're going to close it out with an interview with our great friend, Andrew Barker. I think you'll really enjoy it. Again, I don't want to deceive anyone. We talk about football for the first maybe 5-10 minutes. Once we start getting into Anthony Bourdain, if you're not interested in music, by all means, log off. But if you are, I think you'll really enjoy it. So I want to thank all our listeners. It's been a great week. Please keep supporting the podcast by leaving reviews on iTunes. We've been getting a lot of them. That really helps. Very important that you actually download the podcast, so please subscribe. That makes a big difference. Our numbers are very close to where we need to be, so your support is appreciated. You guys have been giving us great shout-outs on Twitter, so we appreciate it, and I hope everyone has a great weekend and enjoy our interview with Andrew Barker. So we have, for a variety of reasons, we haven't had a guest for the past few episodes, but we're going to more than make it up today with one of my favorites. We're joined by our great friend, Andrew Barker. Those of you into Calcio know him as one of our go-to people for Inter. He's been supporting him for quite some time. Those of you that like the pop culture aspect of the podcast know that he's our guru. Every time we want to talk about movies or music, he is our go-to guy. So today we're going to start with Inter, then we're going to get into Anthony Bourdain, and that's your cue that we're done talking about Calcio. So, Andrew, it's a real pleasure to have you back on Calcio Land. How you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Always glad to be here and happy to talk about Inter, you know, now that there's nothing else going on in the world of football.
We're recording this actually during Spain Portugal, so perfect timing. So last time we had you on was right before that crazy match between Lazio and Inter. You told us you weren't even sure if you're going to watch the game because it was really the potential to be completely crazy, and it more than delivered in that regard. So you've been following Inter for a long time, if I remember correctly, going back to the Ronaldo, the real Ronaldo days. So I wanted to ask you, where does this rank in the power rankings of the Pazza Inter games you've watched in your lifetime?
Well, just real quick, to be clear, I did end up watching the game, and I convinced my wife to let me, like, go to a bar because I just could not watch that at home with a toddler crawling all over me. So I was glad I did. I think it was definitely a classic Pazza Inter entry. I think this season actually gave us two really good sort of models for what a Pazza Inter match is. One was this one, and then the other being the match against Juve, where we came back from one down with 10 men and then just blew it all at the end. So two really, like, exemplary sort of matches to cite there. I guess, like, just thinking about the last decade or so, I think the one thing that would lower it in the Pazza rankings is the fact that the stakes were just kind of lower here a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I think about, like, the real nutty Inter matches recently, I think of, like, matches in the Champions League against, like, Schalke and Barcelona, or the time we beat the hell out of Tottenham one leg, and then Gareth Bale just annihilated us in the away leg, like, and yeah. those were kind of like Pazza Inter on a big scale. So here, you know, it's just within the league for a fourth place finish. Like, the stakes make the craziness a little less, but it's still definitely one of them. And I think it's kind of like there was a match during the Stramaccioni era where we played Palermo during like a blizzard. Like, you couldn't even see the touch line.
I vaguely remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and so Diego Milito scored 4 goals, and yet we still somehow drew with Palermo. Like, so, like, you know, just, you had these freak, like, outside circumstances, and you had brilliant play on one hand and then just catastrophes on the other hand. So I think this is a match that's kind of in line with that, where the number of people who were paying attention was a little bit lower, but it really just shows what this team is all about, I think.
Yeah, and to me, you know, when we've talked about Pazza Inter, I'd say in the past 2-3 years, it usually goes badly for Inter, as you mentioned,
right,
the Juve match being the typical
yeah.
example, and that, for once, it paid off. So I wanted to ask you, I was very surprised at the beginning when I first heard that Nainggolan could be going to Inter. Now I think it's really gaining some traction. I think there's a pretty decent chance this would happen. So let me just ask you, how excited would you be if Nainggolan comes to Inter this summer?
I'd be very excited. You know, I think it's interesting because it kind of feels like that the two real candidates for that kind of star midfield position are Rafinha and Nainggolan. And I just can't think of like two players with more different personalities. You know, like Rafinha is like the kid from the neighborhood who like always had his Boy Scout uniform ironed and, you know, like invited all the kids from his classroom to his birthday party just so no one would feel left out, you know, whereas like Raja is like the kid who like wants to show you his Playboy collection and go back into the alley to smoke kind of thing, you know, like they're just like diametrically opposed personalities. But I would be more than excited to have him come. You know, I think 2 seasons ago for me, he was the best midfielder in the league.
Yeah.
And this last season, like, I guess he took a little bit of a dip. He wasn't quite as dominant. But even then, I still think he was, like, one of the top 5 midfielders in the league. So I know he's 30. I know he's, like, not, you know, the most fitness-oriented Javier Zanetti kind of guy. But, like, unless he really goes on a bender this summer, I think he would still be an improvement on just about every midfield player we have, except for maybe Rafinha, if he's still available. I mean, we just don't have a player who can do the breadth of things that he can do. So I would be all for it.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be honest, what makes this move much more exciting is the fact that you have Spalletti. Him and Nainggolan are really great together. I think he's kind of a little bit, more than a little, on the downside of his career, but I could see with Spalletti him being really, really invigorated. So you mentioned Rafinha as another player who was at Inter on loan with an option to buy that Inter wasn't able to exercise. And it looks like João Cancelo isn't going to come back to Inter. That looks almost certain. And he might end up at your bitter rivals, Juve. So tell me, if that happens, how upset would you be? And what was your assessment of Cancelo overall this last season?
You know, I'd be disappointed if he went to Juve, and I'd have no hesitation to immediately, like, just start despising him and wishing his downfall. But I wouldn't blame him for going to the club, you know? It's like, when you're a player, a lot of your fate is out of your hands. Like, all you can really control is what you do on the pitch. And so Cancelo couldn't control the fact that Spalletti didn't really play him until the second half of the season, and he can't control his valuation or, like, Inter's FFP situation, whether they can sign him. Like, all he can control is what he does on the pitch.
Yeah.
And when he was on the pitch for us, he did more than enough to justify a permanent move. So it's really on Inter that we didn't sign him. And since we didn't, I don't really think, you know, I don't think he should be bound by loyalty to a club that really only played him for half a season and then just kind of left him hanging. I'd love to see him here, but I wouldn't blame him for taking the best option he has now. You know, I thought he was great here, and I wish we'd kept him, but that ship has clearly sailed.
So another aspect of Inter's mercato that I find pretty interesting are Wandanara's Instagram post stories. So she's obviously the better half of Icardi, put that in air quotes, and also his agent. And I got to say, I think she's done really a good job as his agent. She's gotten him raises the past 2 years. My guess is how it ends up. It's going to end up the same way this year, but I find her posts really pretty hilarious. So we had a lot of black and white posts, which seems a subtle sign of interest in Juve, and we know that Juve really likes Icardi. So we had the zebra during the safari, then we had the tank top in black and white. So are you amused by this? Is there any degree of this that concerns you, or do you just think it's fun and games, and are you pretty confident, like me, that ultimately Icardi is going to stay put?
You know, honestly, I didn't even know that had happened because, you know, looking up Wanda's IG at work probably get me in trouble.
At home with your wife, yeah, that much better either.
I think it's funny. I don't read too much into it. I actually agree with you. Like everyone was really kind of clicking their tongues when Icardi hired his own wife as his agent. And maybe that is a good idea. Maybe it wasn't. But she's sort of been like this half Raiola, half Kardashian kind of combination.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
And it seems to work. You know, like, I mean, she's totally a troll, but she gets things done in her own way, you know? So, I don't worry about it. I mean, I don't think there's ever going to be a transfer window where Inter fans don't worry at least a little bit about what Icardi's going to do. But I think that's by design, you know, either for him or for his wife, kind of willing to be the bad guy here, you know, like if he's going to stay at Inter, when he could go to almost any club he wanted to, he's going to want to get maximum value out of being here, right? So I don't fault him for that. He, anything could happen. He could still leave. I just can't see Inter letting Icardi go to Juve, though. I mean, like, remember what happened when Inter almost sold Guarin to Juve?
Yeah.
Like, it was a massive scandal. And, like, and Inter fans don't even like Guarin, you know? It was just, like, the principle of the thing. So to sell, like, the best player we've had in the last half decade to Juve, or, like, this whole idea of Icardi for Higuain, it's like, I mean, even Inter's not that dumb, I don't think. I mean, still anything can happen, but I think it's fun and games. I think he wants a little more money. I think he'll get it, and I think Wanda knows what she's doing.
I agree, and I think the mix between Raiola and Kim Kardashian's brilliant. So, well said there. So, one last somewhat football-related question. This is a good transition to the next part of the interview. This week, I mean, everything right now feels surreal. I mean, sometimes it's really sad, sometimes it's hilarious, sometimes it's a combination of both. So, this week we had Dennis Rodman essentially brokering a world peace deal in Korea. And I wanted to ask you, if you could pick any Serie A player, past or present, to play a similar role, who would it be and why?
You know, I feel like even if you don't ask me about him, Ibrahimovic always comes up.
Sure.
So in his memoir, and by, like, literally everyone listening should read his memoir, I Am Zlatan Ibrahimovic by Zlatan Ibrahimovic, because it's like
great.
A masterpiece of 21st century world literature. But he has this whole thing where he talks about when he first came to Inter and how the dressing room was divided between Brazilians and Argentines, and how he, like, stormed into Moratti's office and said, like, you need to integrate the squad and break down these divisions. And he talks about it like he's Reagan telling Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. Like, it was like this massive diplomatic breakthrough. So, you know, I think Ibra he's less ridiculous than Rodman, and he's played for Inter, Milan, and Juve without being hated. So he knows how to, like, work between borders and enemy lines.
Mm-hmm.
So he's less crazy than Rodman. And I honestly think he knows more about geopolitics than Donald Trump.
Oh,
I think
he'd
get it
sure.
done. I could also see Baggio or Zanetti, you know, being kind of like the good cop finding common ground. Or you could have like a Claudio Gentile, you know, and just like lock those two guys in a room with him. And by the time they came out, they'd both be ready to resign immediately, which that would solve like the larger problem.
That's a great solution.
Yeah. Like, neither of them should be in charge of a country. So just, you know, get them both out. I mean, problem solved, right?
Yeah. So let me ask you, so Zlatan's been in L.A., although now he's in Russia at the World Cup. You've had the Zlatan experience for a little bit in your backyard. So tell me a little bit how that's going. He's like your idol, so this must be quite exciting.
It is. And it was a big deal when he first came. Like people were talking about it to a degree that people don't normally talk about MLS in my social sphere. I feel like the shine has worn off a little bit. I mean, probably just because there's actual, you know, not to put down MLS, but, you know, games that people care about, you know, that are going on.
Yeah.
So, but no, you know, he's still here. He's still scoring. He's still getting red cards for no reason. So, you know, he's still Zlatan. It's all good.
Yeah, definitely exciting, but it seems to me like the soccer aspect was maybe a little bit secondary to his move, so I'm not totally surprised with how it played out. So let's go on a little bit more somber note. I wanted to get your take because I saw your tweets on the subject that were really interesting. So we had Anthony Bourdain shockingly passing away last week. You know, they're definitely a big influence in my life, his shows. I've really enjoyed a lot of the content he's done over the years. You know, he has a seminal book, Kitchen Confidential. I know you tweeted about it. So give our listeners a little bit of sense of what was your reaction to his passing and the influence he's had a little bit in your life, because I know it kind of hit pretty close to home for you.
It did. Yeah, it really did. I think a lot of that is, you know, I first read Kitchen Confidential when I was literally working at just the worst casino restaurant in Las Vegas, just a miserable job. And it really was just sort of something I needed to hear, both because, you know, I'd never heard anyone talking about what it's actually like to work in a restaurant like he did. And just the fact that he was just such a fuck up who managed to kind of get his shit together, at least it seemed, you know, and turn into first a chef and then a great writer and then a, you know, cultural icon, you know? So I really, he was important to me in that sense. And I really looked up to him. And just as a writer, I think, you know, I grew up really admiring guys like Henry Miller and Ernest Hemingway, who are kind of these swaggering macho sort of, male ego writers. And I still love them. But there's a lot of nasty stuff that goes along with them. You know, just sexism, racism, kind of colonialism. And Bourdain had that whole swaggering vibe to him without being that. You know what I mean? Like he was an enlightened, he still had, you know, he was still punk rock, you know, and he was still the guy smoking and swearing and, you know, in the corner. But he had a conscience to him and an awareness of the world that I really, really admired. It was heartbreaking to see what happened.
Yeah, and I totally buy that, you know, what you saw on TV is exactly what he was. I mean, that's what everyone in his crew was saying, and it came off as really, really genuine. So let's transition. What I wanted to talk to you a little bit today, there's a lot of great summer tours going on. I feel like there's all the nostalgia rock acts are out in full force. So I wanted to ask you about some of the bigger ones that are going on, and I want to frame on the U2 side of things this way. So last year, U2 had their big tour for the Joshua Tree that they played their seminal album. This year, they're like, we're not going to do that. If you wanted to hear that album, you should have come last year. You know, they're still charging a lot for tickets, so they put on an amazing show. So I wanted to ask you, a band like them, do you think they have less of an obligation to play the hits at every show than, say, someone like Bon Jovi or Def Leppard or something a little bit more strictly commercial? Or, you know, maybe a band like Guns N' Roses that hasn't been around for a while with the original lineup, they got to play what the people haven't heard in a while. Do you think a band like U2 has more leeway to get away with doing exactly the show that they want to do?
You know, it's an interesting question. And, you know, whether thinking about just U2 or in general, like it all comes down to the fact that being in a band like that on that level is partially being an artist and partially being an entertainer.
Yeah.
And there's no one right way to balance those two. You know, like I kind of came of age as a concert goer in the 1990s. Like I think you did too. And back then there was kind of like a real premium on not being the kind of fan who just wanted to hear the hits, you know,
of course,
it was almost like, I remember like Nirvana wouldn't necessarily play Teen Spirit and Radiohead would like never play Creep or play High and Dry.
They didn't play for like 15 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like, you were kind of a rube if you went in wanting to hear them play those, you know, like it was sort of like you were kind of trying to indulge the band a little bit. And I feel like the pendulum has really shifted to the point where you have bands like going out and playing, you know, like U2, all these bands playing like entire old albums, like front to back, which is great on one hand, because I remember seeing the Pixies do all of Doolittle and seeing Nas do all of Illmatic. And yeah, and like both of those shows were like, you know, here's a great artist playing their absolute best material. Like, how can that be a problem? But it also feels like we're kind of forcing artists to indulge us in our own nostalgia a little too much. You know, it's like I'm saying to Nas, like, hey, Nas, I know you're in your 40s. I know you've made 10 albums since then, but I really just want to hear your first album that you made when you were 19 so I can flash back to when I was 11 and listen to you. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, we're not meeting halfway. And so, like, that's necessary, you know, but you don't want to turn these artists into performing monkeys. You know, like, I remember... People, it used to be whenever people would yell requests at REM concerts, Michael Stipe would just go, I am not a jukebox, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so, I mean, I definitely think a band like U2 can get away with it. And just because they play so much, you know, and they've done the whole Joshua Tree, they're like, okay, we're going to do one for ourselves now. And I think that I think we need more of that. And sometimes you're going to risk disappointing people, you know? Like, I remember going back to Radiohead. I remember seeing Radiohead once in, like, the early 2000s. And they played, I think, almost nothing but Kid A and Amnesiac stuff, which were like the new kind of radical albums at the time.
Yeah,
a lot of people were clearly disappointed, you know, but I thought it was probably the greatest of their shows I've ever seen, you know, so it's just, you know, there needs to be a little more leeway, a little kind of more back and forth, I think.
Yeah, and I think, too, in this day and age, compared to when you and I started going to concerts, like, I remember when I used to go to a concert in the 90s, like, I'd have no idea what to expect. It's not like now I can go online, see the set list, watch the entire show on YouTube before I go. Like, now I feel like you know what you're going to get if you take a second. I mean, I'm going to see them next week, and I know what it's going to be. So I feel like now it's like buyer beware. What I wanted to ask you next is we had you on last year, unfortunately, when Tom Petty passed away, and we talked about his guitar player, Mike Campbell. I think everyone in his band is just tremendous. And, you know, I'm kind of disappointed they really haven't been out on the road. And I think it's great that Mike Campbell now landed on his feet. He's going to be touring with Fleetwood Mac, with Lindsey Buckingham out of the band. So I wanted to ask you, could you have come up with a better landing spot for Mike Campbell than what he ended up with?
That's a good question. You know, I'm glad to see him out there working, you know, getting his payday, because, I mean, I think you agree he's one of the most underrated guitarists.
Absolutely.
In rock and roll. So, yeah, I mean, good that he gets to stay out there, you know. I mean, I think with Fleetwood Mac, there's no way in hell I'm going to go see this show. but, like, I appreciate the fact that Fleetwood Mac, no matter how old they are and no matter, like, how ingrained in the nostalgia they are, they're still, like, a fucking mess, you know. Like why would they, you know, why change now, you know. Are you familiar with the fake Fleetwood Mac phenomenon?
I've heard of it, but not too much.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, I don't want to get too derailed, but I mean, what's great about Fleetwood Mac is that the band was like five different bands before they became the band that everyone knows as Fleetwood Mac, you know? And at one point, like right before they got Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham and became like one of the biggest bands of all time, they literally, so they had, it was mostly just this guy, Bob Welch, who was sort of like doing a lot of the kind of Lindsey Buckingham roles. But they had just gone on tour. So this is like 73 or 74 or something. And they just gone on tour. And then their manager literally put together a band that he just dug up and built them as Fleetwood Mac and sent them around the country on tour. And Fleetwood Mac changed their lineup so often that I guess a lot of people just didn't even like blink when an entirely different group of people went on stage as Fleetwood Mac. And there's this great article about it from Rolling Stone back in the 70s about being on tour with them. And it literally ends with, like, by this time next year, Fleetwood Mac could be an entirely different group of people. And, of course, they were. They were, you know, they became, you know, the Rumors era lineup. But I also think it's funny that they had to get two guitar players to replace Lindsey Buckingham.
But it's because Mike Campbell can't sing at all, right? Is that
right,
why?
Right.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. So they had to get Mike Campbell to do his guitar parts and then Neil Finn from Crowded House to do the vocals, which is kind of a good tribute. You know, anytime someone has to replace you with two people, that means you were...
Yeah.
You're
that's a very good point.
Yeah.
So next thing I wanted to ask you, this year I'm going to take Alex to see Pearl Jam at Fenway Park. You're more than invited to come join us. I know you haven't seen him in a while. So when and I'm not even a huge Pearl Jam fan by any means, as I was telling you yesterday, I don't think they've had a great album since Yield. But at the end of the day, I personally think right now they're the best band that I've seen in a very long time live. So I wanted to ask you, A, what's your pick if you could see any band that you know they're just going to put on a great show every time? And the thing that I like about Pearl Jam is every show is completely different. Like the set list have some things in common, but they change it up every night. Do you like that, or do you prefer more like a pop music perfection of having the same set list played exactly the same way? Like, I feel you could go see Paul McCartney and it's like down to the second, the exact same show. So what do you like best between the two, and what's your favorite to watch?
I like a band that varies it up. You know, I mean, there's lots of, I think Guided by Voices used to never have a set list, and so they literally just make it up as they went along, which is a little too far. But I mean, yeah, I like, you know, I like bands like Pearl Jam that really know how to mix it up. I remember seeing Jay-Z last December, and he's definitely one of those guys who just has his stadium show down to a science. But it was the last night of the tour, and so the end was just 20 minutes of his DJ playing random songs from the catalog. And yeah, Jay seeing if he could remember them, and it was like that was the greatest part of the show. You know what I mean? So I wish people on that level could do things more like that. As for the just, you know, and I feel bad because he was playing at the Bowl and I had to miss him. But you know, Paul Simon is doing allegedly his farewell tour, and he is. I've seen him a couple of times, and every time I see him, I always am just gobsmacked that someone at his age can play that long and that consistently. And his band is absurd. You know, he still has the bass player from Graceland. His guitar player just died. It was this guy, Vincent Nguini. I think he's Cameroonian. But he had been with him since like the 80s, and he was killer. His piano player is like Philip Glass's piano player. So it's like, you're talking about like all these guys from different parts of the world, from different backgrounds of music, who are just at the absolute peak of their abilities, who all come together and play with Paul Simon. And maybe he doesn't even need to have a band that's that good, but I have never seen Paul Simon and not, no matter how good I'm expecting the show to be, it's better than I would expect. So anyone who can still find a way to see him on this last tour who hasn't, I think absolutely should.
I hear his new autobiography is supposed to be amazing. I don't know if you've heard about it. I've heard it's supposed to be really, really excellent.
Yeah, no, I haven't read it. I know Robert Hilburn, who used to be the LA Times critic, just wrote a biography. It's supposed to be really good, too. But I haven't read either. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I wasn't even aware of the autobiography, but
I know he usually never talks about stuff like that, but supposedly they got him to really open up. This is kind of an inside baseball story. I've known you for a little bit through the podcast, and one day, I very rarely get jealous, but one day you sent me something via direct message, a picture of you with Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, which, you know, is really absolutely one of my idols. So I have to ask you a little bit about Nine Inch Nails. They're not touring this summer. They're going to be touring in the fall. I waited 6 hours in line to buy tickets because it was a physical sale to go see them. And this is the first time I've seen Nine Inch Nails live a few times. It's always been, you know, Trent Reznor with a Hired Guns, and he's had some amazing guys, Pino Palladino on bass, who I know you really like. He's had a revolving great musicians. But now he has a full-time member in the band, and that's Atticus Ross. You know, he's done a lot of great soundtracks with him. I think the soundtrack for Social Network works probably the most iconic soundtrack we've had in quite some time. So I wanted to ask you if you were surprised that Trent brought him in as a full-time member of the band, or if you think this was just a natural progression since they've worked so well together on some soundtracks.
I think it's totally natural. You know, I think since, you know, Nine Inch Nails has never really been a band, you know, it's just been Trent and then whoever's helping him on tour in the studio. But he's always had, like, I think it's really hard, unless you're Dylan, to really be just a solo artist. And so I think Trent, like a lot of people, has had really close relationships to his producers. You know, like the first three Nine Inch Nails records were all him and Flood. You know, and that was like very much a partnership. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't just, Flood wasn't like the engineer hitting play while Trent did all that. I mean, he was they made that those albums together. And then he had Alan Moulder for a while, and Atticus Ross, sort of like his third, you know, compatriot in that sense. And I mean, you know, they, not just film scores, but Atticus Ross has been at least producing, co-producing his albums for like well over a decade. I mean, they seem to get each other. I mean, they've won an Oscar together, you know. I try not to do the name droppy thing too much, but also like that night where I got to spend time with Trent, Atticus Ross was there too, like coming in and out, and they have that thing where they kind of talk to each other and it's like they're talking in code. Okay. You know what I mean?
So
they understand each other. I have no idea what just happened there. So clearly they have a connection that works. So that, I think that more than makes sense for him to be an actual Nine Inch Nail.
And Trent is exactly in real life as someone would expect him to be, correct?
So the Trent thing was interesting. Like, not to get all, you know, insidery here, but like, you know, one of the cool things about my job is I occasionally do get to interview people who are like childhood heroes, you know. But usually, like, I'm interviewing them for a story, which is kind of, I mean, it's still cool, but it's kind of a different feeling because it's me doing a job first, you know, where I'm trying to get interesting quotes, trying to get them to open up about things. And they're kind of trying to, and they're aware that anything they say is going to be like quoted, you know. But with Trent, it was, I didn't actually write about him. I was doing a, like,
Q&A, moderating
a Q&A with him. So it was literally like, we just got to spend like 45 minutes just shooting the shit. And it was, he's exactly the person you would think he is, except he's funnier and he's nicer. Like, he's actually very funny. And we spent most of the time talking about our kids, which is hilarious. Cause it, like, I imagine like going back to like 11-year-old me and being like, one day you're going to spend 45 minutes just hanging out with Trent Reznor and you're going to talk about parenting, you know, like, what the fuck happened to my life that, yeah, that this is, yeah, anyway. But no, he's less gothy than you think, but you definitely look at him and it's like, yeah, that guy made the downward spiral. I see that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, last question I have on bands. I know one that you really like, probably almost as much as me. So Slayer on supposedly their retirement tour. I think one thing that stands out to me about Slayer is that I think there's few bands that have been as successful as they have been that have stayed completely true to themselves. So I take it pretty seriously when they say that this is it. I don't really take it as a Kiss, Cher, or Ozzy Osbourne saying we're retiring just to get more urgency for fans to go. So what's your take on that? Do you agree that this is probably it for them? And what do you think their legacy is ultimately going to be?
Yeah, I definitely think this is it for them, you know. Because, I mean, like playing in a band like Slayer is like really more like being an athlete, you know, than being a musician. And I think you look at Tom Araya, and he's kind of been looking like Francesco Totti in like those last couple seasons, you know, where it's like he's still capable of greatness, but his body is wearing down. You know, I mean, he's had a lot of health problems.
Yeah.
Not like, I mean, and not like, you know, but I mean like athlete injuries, you know, like,
yeah, he can't headbang anymore.
Back problems, and he can't headbang anymore. Yeah. I mean, so it's, I mean, and you know, it's thinking about, you know, we kind of touched on earlier too, but just how many musicians have died prematurely recently because they were trying to stay out on the road and do what they couldn't do physically anymore. You know, Tom Petty, Prince, going back to Jerry Garcia, even, you know. So playing Angel of Death every night is not something you can do when you're pushing 60. So I hope this is it for them. And also, you know, I hope it's it for them because I think Slayer's legacy really is being the one major metal band from their era who never compromised.
Even, absolutely.
You know, even if they could have, even if maybe they should have, like financially speaking. So you don't want to see them out there with only two of the original members, like playing War Ensemble at 3/4 speed, you know, and then not looking up to it. You know what I mean? I feel lucky. I got to see them on their last tour with the original lineup and they still sounded exactly like you want Slayer to sound. So I mean, I wouldn't begrudge them if they wanted to carry on because I mean, people have to eat, but I think it would be great to see them just sort of fade with dignity. And as for the, I mean, so that's part of their legacy. And, you know, I think that I mean, when you think about what Slayer meant, I mean, obviously they were the same way Black Sabbath is kind of the grandfather of every metal band.
Yeah.
I think of Slayer as being the grandfathers of like the kind of more extreme genre, sort of branches of metal, you know, like the death metal, black metal, et cetera. And, you know, those aren't necessarily genres I listen to, but they deserve a lot of credit for that. And for me, Slayer, maybe because I'm a wuss, maybe because I'm old, but for me, they represent sort of like the end point of heavy extreme music. Like any metal to me that's faster
as far
than Slayer,
as you'll go, because I'm kind of the same way now. Yeah, I agree.
Anything
totally
faster
with
than
you.
Slayer just sounds like noise. And anything that's like lyrically more extreme either just sounds silly or just sounds unpleasant. Like Slayer is as fast and as evil as I want metal to be, where it's still awesome. You know, if that makes
sense.
Yeah,
that's such a perfect description. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. So before I let you go, you just posted your interview with Future. I love all your work on Variety. So tell our listeners why they should check out the story, and what else have you been working on recently, Andrew?
That was a fun story. Just talking to Future, you know, he did this soundtrack for Superfly. And he's an interesting guy. He was a little out there, but it was fun to talk to him. I have a pretty big story coming out in a week or two that I guess I can't really talk about, but it'll be fun, about someone you've heard of. So just easing into the summer here.
Awesome. Well, listen, Andrew, I can't thank you enough. It's always great to have you on. For you guys that are into movies, music, there's few people better than Andrew, senior writer for Variety. Follow him, and we love having you on Talking Calcio. So I look forward to a future chat, buddy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Always, man. Thanks.